Good afternoon. So, hopefully you're here for 4630. I see our number of participants does not equal the number enrolled, so presumably some people are using the recording, which I guess will be the first bit of logistics I'll get to. So lectures are, as you can see here, via Zoom. I'm going to record them. Hopefully all the recordings will work. I'm not going to require attendance. I would recommend attendance because if you have questions, it's probably easier to ask live, but I'm not going to try to enforce that. I'm going to look mainly at the chat for questions, which is usually the best way as far as how much interruption there would be. I'm going to try to ask questions during lecture and use Zoom's poll feature. I'm not going to be grading any of those questions or recording who answers them. They're more for discussion and to give you a place to check that you aren't totally confused, and for me to check that you aren't totally confused, and so on. So it's on lectures. Prerequisites. So this class has a prereq of 3710. My impression is that this course has been taught with some variation. So I'm hoping this won't be too much of a problem, but I'm not sure how well I'll be able to calibrate, you know, what you know from the prior course. We're going to be doing a lot of things that involve binaries, so knowledge of C, C++, and assembly, and we're going to use x86-64 assembly because that's the machines we have easy access to. So all those would be helpful. 2150 is where that is theoretically covered. 3330 might be some review, or you know, you might have some other assembly review if you're like a CPE student in some CPE ECE courses. We're going to do a bit of refresher of some things about assembly because we're going to talk about things that don't come up in other classes and because people have forgotten it anyways. The class, we're going to have some homework assignments. They're going to be approximately 1 week. I haven't decided what all of them are. The ones where I have some idea are on the schedule. Mostly I copied from the last time I taught this course, which was before 3710 existed. So things are likely to change for especially the later assignments. Assignments are mostly due Friday at 11:59 p.m. But see the calendar for specifics. There is a late policy. It is on the website under policies. You should look at it. Assignments generally, we're going to have some stuff at the beginning of the semester, which is kind of reverse engineering oriented, figuring out what some code does. This is something that comes up a lot when we're talking about the main topic of this course, which is going to be malware, bad software. Well, if you want to deal with bad software, you want to know what it does. And also, we're going to talk about exploits, about making software do things it's not supposed to do. And reverse engineering sort of skills are very useful there. So we're going to start with some reverse engineering assignments. And most of the assignments in this class are sort of based around exploits, so we'll have a bunch of assignments on that. We'll go into the details of assignments as we get further along. So quizzes. I'm going to have weekly quizzes. This is similar to what you may have seen me do in other classes I teach. They will be released after the Wednesday lectures and due before the Monday lectures. They will use an online quiz system I will demonstrate on Wednesday. That's going to not be a surprise to you if you've taken 3330 or 4414 with me. And these will be a large portion of the grade because I'm not doing any midterms. So instead of midterms, basically we have quizzes. I'm planning on having a final assignment, which may end up being sort of a final assignment and a final quiz, like half and half. But there will be at least some sort of more big homework component that we'll use our final time for. So textbooks are always a question. There's no required textbook. Some of the lecture material on malware is based on when Davidson sort of made this course before 3710 existed, which is based off this book Peter Shore's The Art of Computer Virus Research and Defense. We'll also have some topics which aren't really covered there. Partly because I don't think a lot of the things in this course are as relevant today, and there's other topics we want to get to that are more important. We have, for getting help, office hours. We'll use a Discord. There is a Discord invite on Colab that you can use. We have an office hour queue, which there should be instructions on the Discord or on the website on using it. It's mainly sorted by the last time helped. If we get a big queue, which hopefully won't happen, the first three students get a number. I'm mentioning this because we would not like you to decide, oh, there's office hours at 10 a.m. next tomorrow, so it's 11 p.m. now, I'll just sign up to reserve my place in the queue. We might reset things so that doesn't work because we don't think that's healthy for our office hours or for the sort of incentives it creates. I will note, I have some office hours which I will be holding. I'm also teaching OS. My plan is to have both of the queues open and to kind of switch between them. If that doesn't work out, maybe I'll set up separate times for each class and adjust the calendar accordingly. But that's my plan right now, which may mean that it may look like that you're just waiting for no one, but I might be there during some office hour times. Our TAs should have office hours just for this class. Other ways of getting help, we have a Piazza, which is linked on Colab. I and TAs will monitor. If you have questions that sort of involve code or things like that, use a private question on Piazza. If it's actually something that doesn't involve sort of anything that shouldn't be shared, you know, go ahead and use a public question. And if you have questions about what's appropriate to share, first consult the policies page and then talk to me if you have any questions about what's appropriate there. So questions on logistics. Okay, I'm not seeing any. Questions, will the quizzes be like 30-30 with a mix of free choice and free response, multiple choice and free response? Yes, that is what I would anticipate. I intend for the quizzes to be auto-gradable because I have two TAs for this class. You may notice I have like 90 students. And my two TAs total like 19 hours a week, and I probably should have more like 30 for this class. So I'm going to try to minimize how much actual grading work my TAs do to give you more help time. Other questions? Okay, so not seeing any. Okay, so on a logistics adjacent issue, just a note on ethics, which should just be review from 3710. But standard things, don't use someone's computer without their permission. This includes like the university's computer or in excess of what permission you have. So we're going to talk about exploit techniques. I don't feel like I should need to say this, but just a reminder, don't do it. Don't do it just if it's a harmless prank. You know, you could do something wrong. There could be unintended consequences. And don't assume you get permission. If you'd be hesitant to ask, it's wrong. It's not okay. Also, on a legal note, you know, it's probably illegal. And this includes cases which you may be able to very confidently argue are completely moral. But that's not how the law works. So, I'm not going to give you legal advice because I'm not a lawyer. But, just because you might think, we could backhack into some remote malware and, save a lot of people from being infected. Maybe you could. Probably illegal. So don't do those sorts of things without talking to a lawyer. We're going to have assignments where you exploit particular programs and so on in this class. But, we want you to be aware of just don't abuse this. And don't assume that just because, you're doing something that seems helpful, that accesses people's computers without permission, that it's going to be okay. Okay. So that's on law ethics. Any questions about that? Okay. So, traditionally, the main topic of this class is malware. And what do I mean by malware? I mean evil software. And sort of a classic example would be like this screenshot here. This is ransomware saying, this evil software locked up your files and it's going to charge you hundreds of dollars to unlock them, at least allegedly. Who knows if you can confirm that they'll actually do this? And have the tutorial on how to use Bitcoin, because there's not good ways for them to get the money elsewhere without getting prosecuted. And we're gonna talk about things like, how would software like this work? What can we do to detect it? Sort of how could it get installed on systems without people, obviously not deliberately installing it if they're the deliberate owner of the system. And there's actually a wide variety. And we're going to first start talking about sort of what's out there, why have people made malware, and what different types of malware there are. Useful for thinking about the details of how it works. So, malware, mal for evil. So malware is evil software. And this has, a whole range of evil things it can do. It can display a funny message. It could steal information. It could delete data. Could, do insert ads. There's a lot of things that malware encompasses, but sort of all of them are, in some sense, bad or, evil. And generally, not something that someone would actually willingly install on a machine they control. Now, when people talk about malware, they often colloquially refer to, getting malware on your machine as getting a virus on your machine. We're going to use the term virus to mean something more specific. We're going to use the term virus to mean malware that inserts itself into another program. So there's some legitimate program which was modified to have the evil code in it, and viruses will spread by adding themselves to other programs, and this would be how they spread between users. And viruses used to be the biggest concern about malware back when people were more likely to share executable files around. And these days they aren't, but the history is that viruses were the number one concern, which is why you hear the term antivirus software. This is how most anti-malware software markets itself, as antivirus, even though viruses in this sense are not most of what they're protecting you from. Now, this idea of virus here sounds like, you have to be sharing actual executables, but perhaps one of the most common types of viruses were sharing executables, but not the kind of executables you usually think of. So, for example, macroviruses have historically, to some extent, and some enterprise environments perhaps still are, one of the biggest kinds of viruses, and these are viruses which are, you know, not, you know, executable programs like EXEs, but written in a scripting language and in something like a Word or Excel document, because Word and Excel support scripting, and my understanding is that many big companies have people who've really used this scripting capability for legitimate things, but it gives the capability to spread to other files that can contain these scripts. And, you know, that's sort of a big, it was a big problem. Also, a convenient way to spread viruses, right? We don't think about, you know, sharing programs, but we think about sharing, you know, Office documents, and that would be how these would spread, is that you'd open up an Office document with a macro that would run somehow and infect other Office documents that you'd also share to people. And this provoked a reaction which has hopefully mostly made the problem of macros be not a big deal, which is that they're disabled by default. If you have a document that actually uses macros and open it up in Word or Excel or similar programs, you'll probably get, say, you know, them being disabled or at least, you know, not able to, like, infect your other documents. So that's viruses, including this special category of macroviruses. So these are malware that is part of, you know, legitimate programs made by modifying those legitimate programs, and usually which automatically modifies those legitimate programs, or in the case of these macro viruses, you know, documents which can contain programs. So, another big category of that's commonly confused with viruses is worms. So these, like viruses, kind of spread by themselves. So viruses, because they're embedded in other programs and documents, the idea is that, well, people are going to share those things, and that's why they end up everywhere. Worms are independent programs that copy themselves and, you know, try to blend in, look like an innocent program, and, like, copy, if you insert a USB key, try to run automatically or spread over the network. The network being probably the most prominent examples of these, is that if there's some way of installing a program remotely over the network because some piece of software is broken, worms are the big thing you're worried about, sort of doing this automatically and automatically spreading from one machine to another. But unlike viruses, these are independent programs. They aren't going to be, you know, embedded in something else. They'll just be hidden as normal files, possibly in some place where you'd expect there to be independent, useful programs. But as something actually independent that you could remove independently without, like, excising it from a legitimate Word document, for example. So another common category are what are known as Trojans or Trojan horses, and these are sort of useful-looking programs that are actually malware. And distinguished from sort of viruses, this is not something which sort of automatically modifies existing programs. This is something where someone deliberately crafted a useful-looking thing that's actually malware. So, for example, some cracked versions of commercial software, you know, would be considered Trojans because someone manually, for example, made a copy of Photoshop, which doesn't ask for a license, but also does something evil, and made it available for download, but it's not a virus if it just doesn't automatically, like, spread to other files. Or other examples might be someone might have fake antivirus software that it will tell you this is antivirus software, but really all it does is pretend to be antivirus software and ask you for money. And these programs might vary. Some of them might actually be useful and also do something bad on the side, or some of them just might be just a bait and switch. But we distinguish this from viruses because, you know, this isn't something which spreads automatically. Someone did the work of crafting the useful-looking thing and having it go in to your system by somewhat you deliberately looking for it and getting it from them or from someone who got it from them. I'm sort of, as a concrete example of this, so one case where people might try to do this is, you know, you look for places where people are just getting software, and you distribute sort of a bad version of it. So this is from last year. You know, a lot of Chrome extensions, because that's a piece of software you download, you know, some had versions of them which, you know, did something that you didn't want, maybe created by modifying something that, you know, did something legitimate and adding some extra functionality to, say, you know, send your browser information somewhere that where they could sell it or display ads. You know, this is an example of sort of a Trojan horse sort of scenario where someone modified legitimate software into evil software, and maybe it was still useful for its purported task, but also did this additional bad thing. Now, for all these types of malware I've talked about, sort of a common attribute is that they've all been kind of misrepresented to the person getting them. That either in the case of a virus, it, you know, it's kind of hidden. And in the case of these Trojans, like it's trying to show us something that it's not. There's sort of a contentious category commonly known in the industry as potentially unwanted program, or sometimes a potentially unwanted application. So PUP or PUA for short. Where, unlike our Trojan horse, they disclose what they're doing, but they don't do things that people would probably actually want to install. So, a classic example of this is a cheap laptop might come with some software that displays extra ads on web pages. That's probably disclosed to you in the setup in some fine print. But it's probably an unwanted piece of software, even though, you know, it's arguably, you know, giving you better coupon deals or whatever else they'll claim is the reason you might want to install it. But this is a contentious category because, unlike malware, you know, if you think about, you know, did these companies like illegitimately install this software? Legally, the answer is, you know, not clear, unlike these other cases of Trojan horses and worms, where it is very clear that there's no reason this should be there. And kind of related to this, there's sort of normal programs which do things which we would consider kind of bad. So, for example, a lot of cell phone apps collect location info, often because they want the location info for their advertising targeting. And, you know, it came out in the press that, well, a lot of these pieces of software were selling these to data brokers who aggregated this data and sold it to people who wanted to use it for whatever. And so this is a case where, you know, there's kind of some kind of disconnect between what you expect the software to do and what it actually does. That's kind of in this potentially unwanted program category, but sort of the primary functionality of the software is legitimate, unlike most of our traditional potentially unwanted programs, and it's not like a legitimate piece of software with something added like our Trojan extensions that you might find being a normal extension with sort of spyware added onto it. And these fuzzy edges are a case where sort of malware gets to be a tricky thing. So I have a bit of a discussion question here. I'll do set up poll. So let's say you're making some anti-malware software. So you're making some software that someone's going to use on their laptop or phone, and you find these two pieces of software. What do you do about it? What should your software do? So one is we have a browser extension that displays coupon codes, but to do so, there's some third party which gets the domain names of all the websites you visit. And there's another one is some remote administration software, something you can use to like access your laptop remotely, if you're, away to like do something, and it displays a little icon in the corner of the screen when it's being remote controlled. It's pretty subtle-like. Okay, and this is not the split I was expecting when I wrote this question, so that's interesting. Okay, so with most people answering, we have the plurality answer is to prompt to remove each of these, defaulting to yes. And surprising me, more people want to remove the remote administration software without prompting than the pre-installed thing. And we have very few other options. And we have, but for the remote administration software, we have some people who say don't flag it. We don't have anyone who says that for our pre-installed extension. So anyone want to make a case quickly for any of their answers here? Especially if you aren't in the anyone who's not getting an answer, prompt remove default to yes, want to make a case.
Well.
So Mia can, if you had something to say, I guess.
I mean, yeah, I put don't flag it for the remote administration software. And I might have just been misunderstanding what it was doing. But it seemed to me that it was a good idea that it shows a subtle icon in the corner of the screen when used to monitor the machine, which kind of ensured that there'd be some indication so that it would, you could still use it to remotely access your machine, but if someone else was trying to use it, that you would be aware of it because there, I guess it could be a stronger than subtle, but it still seems like it's something you could
okay.
be aware of.
Yeah, so, okay,
that's
so,
good behavior.
Yeah, and people can use raise hand, which is probably better for doing this, but yeah, so your argument is that, this would make sense because we could, it's not going to be secret to the user that it's happening, and it's not, presumably someone installed it, That's a reasonable argument. So in the chat, there's, I guess the concern with the remote admin software being more concerning is that it's modifying your display versus just monitoring your data. So I think the argument there is that since it's showing something on the display, it's not subtle. So hopefully that modifying display is an advantage. And, but, and Nasrat?
Hello.
And you can correct my pronunciation of your name, by the way, if that's needed.
Yeah, that's fine. So for number one, I put something else discuss for the pre-installed browser extension.
Mm-hmm.
So this might be a matter of interpreting the question, which I suppose is fine for it because it's an opinion question. But so pre-installed browser extension. I was wondering if that was pre-installed by the browser, by the computer manufacturer, whatever.
Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah, so you're saying if it's pre-installed, it matters what it came with. You know, if it's just a normal part of the browser, you might think it's less bad. And that's a good, a reasonable thing to say. It would depend on that, right?
Right, yeah. And so I would think that if the extension has to send, like, domain names of your websites to third parties, that would be by design and not by, that could potentially not be by malicious intent.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a prompt to remove it, I would say, but rather it would be less of a sort of cautionary prompt and more of a just kind of, hey, this is like just a like a resource monitor basically saying, yeah, this extension or whatever is sending these resources just to let you know.
Yeah.
Rather than making any sort of like tells over to whether or not it's malicious, because it could be the case that the extension itself is malicious or the browser is malicious for including that extension.
Okay. Yes. But your argument is pointing out that, like, so I think something you're bringing up here with our first example here is that, oh, if it sends the domain name, it might just need to do that. Right. That's sort of argument that doesn't indicate that it's actually really malicious.
Because a lot of extensions do that, especially even like ad blockers, they kind of...
They might need to do... Yeah, it makes sense to do that. It's a reasonable way of writing it. I wouldn't say they need to do that. I think you can make an ad blocker which never sends your websites to do user. But it, like, as a design, it doesn't indicate that they were trying to steal your information.
Or say some kind of extension that like reroutes your thing to an older version of the site. Just kind of throwing out examples.
Yeah, okay. And I see, looking at the chat, so people saying things about remote admin software, which is our second example, which is worth pointing out that, okay, so this software, the bad thing is you don't want people to remotely take over your machine who aren't supposed to, but you know, this would be a software you might actually want. For example, if you travel often, you know, want to get a machine which is not where you are. And also pointing out that, oh, it was probably installed intentionally. You know, presumably the person installing it knew what they were doing. So, and Zane?
Hi. Yeah. So that was pretty much the gist of it. What I was thinking too for the second question, at least. Generally, these are like remote administration softwares are installed intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've actually had one installed on a PC previously because I had to go through some Microsoft support stuff, and like it's pretty obvious. I mean, it's not super obvious, but like that subtle icon that shows that there's somebody like monitoring or controlling the machine is, you know, like it's there and you can tell. And generally, like somebody who has this on their computer, unless it's installed by like a malware, like probably doesn't want it, you know, removed or prompted for removal.
Okay.
Yeah,
so that makes sense. So you're saying, the argument that it's legitimately installed. And I guess another thing someone's bringing up in the chat, which is a good point, is question about who is our anti-malware software for. Like, if this is a company machine, there might be monitoring software on the company machine, which might be that remote administration software, you know, and we don't want the employee to remove it. But I think that, to think about that scenario, like, we need to know, like, who's running this anti-malware software? Is it the sysadmin? Is it employee? And so on. Okay. Any other sort of comments on these scenarios, things people think about? Before I go to my next slide and bring up something that is particularly relevant to our second piece, second scenario. So your question is, could have been legitimately installed to still pose a threat? That's exactly what I'm going to get to. So one category of sort of malware intersecting with not malware is what this academic paper calls intimate partner violence. You might call more colloquially domestic abuse, where we have things that are kind of dual use. So people who have interviewed domestic abuse survivors who have been harassed by somewhat technically sophisticated partners have found things like, you know, using, say, a Find My Phone software, which has a 100% legitimate use, or sort of remote administration software, you know, which has a legitimate use, for these illegitimate use of harassing someone who you're in an abusive relationship with. And this sort of dual use stuff, like that, we could have this Find My Phone app be used for finding your phone, or, you know, dealing with your phone being stolen, or someone who got access to your phone because they're your partner, tracking you after you've broken up, is sort of what makes this sort of identifying our precisely kind of tricky. Like, it's context sensitive. A lot of there is really stuff which, you know, could be considered malware, is something you definitely want to get rid of, and is, you know, just a normal thing. So in this class, we're mostly going to dodge this question, and we're mostly going to be talking about anti-user software that tries to be converted. But if we're actually dealing with this problem in the real world, you also need to consider this question of sort of this dual use issue. And sort of these fuzzy lines. So an example of, in this intimate partner violence case, there's some software out there which advertises itself as, oh, this is just for remote control of your device. In this case, they're talking about for a phone, but the equivalent likes for a computer, for a laptop. Or this is just for, you know, sharing where your partner is. But may just be conspicuously designed to not be as apparent as it should be. Or might be marketed on a How to Spy on Your Partner blog. And for the most part, we're not going to talk about this, but something depending on our schedule, we may want to go through is sort of the issue of not just the sort of this clearly anti-user software, but, you know, what we can do to prevent these sort of bad uses. And one thing, for example, we might think about is how can our phone OS prevent covert tracking? And this comes up in this sort of very extreme domestic abuse context, and comes up in the arguably less extreme thousands of apps that happen to collect your location information and sell it context. That we want to design things so that these incidental bad uses aren't possible, even if we're not just eliminating these pieces of clearly anti-user software. But we're going to talk for most of the class about, you know, things that are definitely malicious, where it's not such a gray area. And on that note, sort of our the main type of malware we're going to be thinking about are the sorts of things that usually has a profit motive, which is what I'll get to next. But before I move on to that, any questions about this sort of dual use topic and, you know, sort of this fuzzy line about malware versus potentially unwanted program versus normal software? So, as I said, the biggest category of malware out there is people trying to make money, what you might call cybercrime. And there's sort of these different types of malware that are, you know, big categories of this, and we're going to look at some of them. Now, as I talk about this, sort of, we're going to try to look at statistics to, like, look at what these types of malware are, and most of the statistics you can get about what malware is out there come from antivirus companies, because they're in the kind of position where they have access to data about what happens on their customer systems, but they're a biased data source. They kind of have an interest in making the problem seem big and making the problem seem like something that they can address. So take all these statistics with a grain of salt. But as an example, let's look at this graph from anti-malware company FireEye, which has a product called which has a division called Mandiant, of the types of malware they found. This categorization doesn't give us a precise idea of how they're making money, but we have what they call Dropper, which is install other malware, I believe. Credential Stealer, which is, you know, steal login info. So presumably banks, email account, they don't have a breakdown on which. Ransomware, which is old files, ransom, until you pay, and POS stands for point of sale, an unfortunate acronym, which is trying to gather financial info, which could be reused for fraud. And backdoor is covert access to machine from a remote system, which could be used for a lot of things. So this gives you sort of, big categories, but kind of annoyingly for figuring out what people are doing, a bunch of these categories, like most of this is like covert access. What are they doing with that? Well, whatever they want, and installing other malware. Now, a remarkable thing about sort of the world of making money from malware and cybercrime in general is that it's not the case that we have someone who writes a piece of malware and, like, gets some credit card numbers and then uses those credit card numbers on Amazon and gets something. That's not how it works. There's more indirection than that. And one example of the indirection that exists comes from, you know, this dropper category, that there's a bunch of sort of malware out there that's in this pay per install category. What some criminals do is that they say, I'm really good at installing malware on machines, you know, compromising machines, and getting malicious software installed on there, but I don't actually have, you know, the expertise to do the best job about writing the most profitable evil software. So I'm just going to sell installing your malware that you supply me on N machines for some price. And they'll do something like say, oh, you know, they'll sell, I will get your malware installed on US-based machines for $5 an install, and they will sell that on some shady place to some other criminal who will actually use that malware. So this paper here is some researchers got machines with the paper install malware, the malware that installs other malware, and looked at what was installed in this case 10 years ago, or 11 years ago. And you can see that, you know, people were paying to get, you know, software that sent spam, software that installed more software, so all the way down, software that did click fraud. So what's click fraud here? This is fraudulently clicking on ads to take money from ad companies that they think are paying for users to click on ads. And botnet, so this is the, what was that backdoor category? So using the machines for computation, or most likely at this time for, you know, things like denial of service, or possibly spam. We have here fake AV, so this is fake antivirus software, which basically, you know, the typical model is you are infected until you pay the license, until you pay for the non-trial version. That's the typical way that fake antivirus software has been monetized, is that they do that. We have info stealing information like logins and so on. So you can see, and other category you haven't seen here is distributed denial of service, which hopefully was mentioned in 3710. So you see this sort of whole universe of different kinds of bad software, and in this case, all installed by sort of a couple of services that are sold to criminals to get these installed on machines, because the people who are, say, writing this click fraud software here don't actually specialize in installing their click fraud software on machines that will click on the fake ads, but, you know, hire someone else to do that. And this sort of market is sort of a lot of how, you know, actual cybercrime works, is that it's not the case that any one criminal does the whole process. They kind of pay people to do each part. Each of them takes their cut. Some questions about our paper install example here. Okay, Samuel?
These people who are distributing the malware and the ones who are getting paid for the installs, is their methodology generally through phishing and sneaking in the other viruses into software?
I don't recall. So, presumably this paper mentions how this software was installed. I didn't actually check because it was 2010 and presumably things have changed.
Makes sense. Okay. I was just curious as to how someone could not have the expertise to actually make good malware, but at the same time have
the expertise. So the thing, so the people, yeah. So like ways they could do it include things like making a Trojan, like a good an installer people will want to install for some software or something like that, or exploiting a vulnerability, which would not be the specialty of like people writing click fraud software.
Got it. Okay, makes sense.
The question, so you're saying, so in theory, they could be good social engineers who don't know how to code. I believe that most of these sort of pay per install are on a scale where, well, actually, the price per install is probably too low for it to be something where there's actual sort of manual effort for each install. But, you know, like setting up an attractive Trojan or something might be a thing they do. And Gustavo?
Yeah, I guess I was thinking that one could easily imagine that if you're good at installing malware, you could just install multiple different malware together and sort of like package it. So you, like one install could potentially pay for several paper installs.
So the paper install things, they install, one of the things they do is they install multiple pieces of malware on one machine. This is kind of a tricky issue because from a value perspective, getting your malware installed on a machine with other malware also installed on it is less valuable than if you're the only one. It's kind of a tension they have in pricing their service. But like from a perspective of making money, like, you know, if all these types of malware make money, you might as well get them all installed, and you probably don't have the time to do sort of the back end for making money from all these different types of bad software you could install. And Roberto?
Yeah, I just want to ask, what was the days column for? Like, what does that signify?
I think it's the number of days they detected the software being used in their sort of their infected machines they were monitoring. I need to read the paper to make sure.
Okay.
The paper is linked off the schedule, I believe. Since these things are entertaining reading. At least I think so. Okay. And I think anything else? So, you have these categories which kind of showed up. So, we've seen sort of advertising fraud. So, but probably the more prominent type of malware, which didn't come up here, well, it does come up here, sorry, is adware, is the most prominent type of ad malware, because these are malware which makes revenue from ad revenue, and sort of the most common thing you do is you modify the browser to show more ads. So this is our a screenshot of, there's a few extra ads on this page that you would not normally see on Amazon. And sort of installing this surreptitiously, maybe being a little more subtle about it is a way you can, is a way malware can make money. And this is also a major category of potentially unwanted software programs. And probably like the most biggest public incident of potentially unwanted programs that came out was when some potentially unwanted programs, so like pre-installed in the fine print, but probably not what you wanted, not nearly this blatant because they couldn't get away with that. But there was a VC-backed firm called Supervish, so like with some people spent $19 million funding, which paid to be pre-installed on some Lenovo laptops. I guess I should have checked what happened to that venture. So these are old slides, but it's still a relevant example. And Google found in this study here from 2014 that 5% of people accessing Google had code from this company that would insert ads into pages. Not this many ads, but would insert extra ads. So I believe since 2014, since things like Google doing the work to figure this out, this has gotten a lot better, and this is probably part of why like Chrome extensions are a little trickier now. This was a big issue and is still a way you can make money because it's relatively easy to set up an ad account. So going back to our list of categories, so another category I mentioned was ransomware. So we saw that example at the beginning. So this is typically we've encrypted your files, pay to decrypt them, and maybe they'll actually decrypt them if you pay, maybe they won't. And also this sometimes happens in sort of typically in more targeted cases, we have your private data, usually for a company which might have some private data that they might be willing to pay to not release. That's making money. So another example, sort of mundane, is reselling personal info. So one thing you could imagine doing is doing something like a keylogger, meaning record key presses, meaning passwords, which apparently has sometimes been done, though it's tricky to get money out of that because basically then you need to sell the passwords to someone who can actually use them. Probably a concrete example I can give of that is there seems to be money in selling browser history data, which has been seen in, sort of example, hijacked Chrome extensions, where someone would pay for the extension and that would add code, which would send basically the entire browser history somewhere, maybe inject ads, but it's not clear whether or not they would do that, they actually ever did that. But presumably there's money from just selling history information and possibly injecting ads, or stealing other info from pages. And another category is this reselling the computation or network time. So all these sorts of categories depend on, you know, getting the malware on, you know, malware on an important system and interfere with it. But also, a bunch of malware sort of makes money kind of in spite of the system it's on. So advertising fraud is when it was the example I started with. So this is basically you click on ads on quote-unquote your web page, but actually no one's clicking. It's just some software that's doing it. And the reason you'd want to use compromised machines for this is that if Google sees all their ad clicks are coming from your basement, they'll say, wait a moment, but if they're coming from all over, you know, they might pay you for them. And based on the reports of law enforcement and advertising brokers like Google, you know, this is like a tens of millions, hundreds of millions sort of criminal industry, maybe more than that. Yeah, distributed denial of service. Having just random machines somewhere is a useful place to do that, and you know, sort of cryptocurrency mining is another sort of classic example of if you have some computational power, well, It's probably not very efficient, but they're free or almost free, like pay per install. If you're getting a machine that's in some less wanted country, is like less than a dollar per install, if you might be able to make that up with cryptocurrency mining. Okay. Now, these sorts of ways of making money here are sort of very general. These are things you can do on pretty much any machine. There's also sort of examples of people being more targeted about it, which are maybe more concerning. So, one example of a class of malware that, you know, if we look at my taxonomy here, kind of falls into this reselling personal info, but something with a rather different motivation are what are called remote access Trojans. And these are typically things where people basically install covert remote administration software. But, you know, sort of unlike those prior examples of malware, where it's sort of about making money at scale, these are things which might be controlled individually by a human operator. And, I mean, hopefully since this 2016 study, things have gotten better about detecting them, but, you know, as this abstract mentions, you know, we have people using them for, using this sort of software for sophisticated things. They have a particular target they want to do espionage on, where that espionage might be if you're a criminal, like someone who has a bank account you want to use, and for sort of less sort of industrial scale crime, like sort of voyeurism and individual extortion. And sort of as an example, in this study, they basically set up some machines to compromise with one of these remote access tools, and using the functionality of that tool, you know, 61% of their attackers attempted to access the webcam, which wasn't present on their experimenters' machines, so they didn't get anything. But, you know, this is a very different pattern than the let's infect tons of machines and make a little money from each of them. This is sort of very personal and often also trying to harass the user and things like that. So I mentioned sort of these uses of malware, and when I talked about this idea of pay-per-install, I gave you this idea that people kind of specialize and sell services, and sort of as a concrete example of that, this is a old article here, but here is, you know, if like, if you're stealing info from someone, you know, what do you do with that? Well, this is from a IRC channel. IRC is Internet Relay Chat, still exists, a lot less popular than it used to be in 2006, but this is not the handle that this person used, but there were sort of underground places, some of them perhaps not underground enough, because if the people who wrote this paper could find them, it obviously helped law enforcement to find them, but saying like, oh, you know, I have these credit card numbers with social security and driver's license and, you know, sort of these other illegitimate services, packed machines, and so on, and compromised e-commerce site. And, you know, I'm going to sell them because, you know, that's how you make money off it, this sort of thing. You don't just, like you might imagine, it's not the case that I hack into a, you know, machine and get your credit card number. It's not the case that I'm going to use that credit card number, I guess. And directly, I'm probably going to sell it to someone who knows how to do that, because that's a high-risk activity. And probably what this person did is that they got a bunch of credit card numbers from some e-commerce site that was vulnerable, and this is how, and they're going to sell it to someone who knows how to turn that credit card number into money for a surprisingly low price, because, well, a whole bunch of these probably won't actually get you money because banks will like stop transactions, and you have to do weird things to turn a credit card number into money if the transaction is going to be canceled or a credit card might be reported stolen and so on. And there are these other services people ask for, which is sort of part of monetizing this, you know. So people who, oh, you know, I have Bank of America and Wells Fargo logins. I need someone who will turn that into money, which is what the drop man will be. And also pointing out that this is, since this is an illegitimate market, there are people who will scam other criminals. That's a thing that happens a lot. But somehow these things survive. And there's kind of this whole, you know, sort of ecosystem of this, and sort of we talked about, oh, you know, mention these pay-per-install services and this sort of idea of people who are going to churn your, you know, your credit cards into money. But there's, you know, people sell sort of all these sorts of components, and the way a lot of online crime, probably not all of it, works is that people are just doing sort of one of these tasks, that someone knows how to send your spam, but they're not necessarily the ones actually like responding to it. Someone knows how to do the ad fraud, but they're not the ones installing the software. Someone knows how to get accounts to host your ad fraud, but they're not the ones, you know, writing the software and so on. And, okay, so I guess a last category of sort of types of malware to talk about, so I kind of alluded to targeted attacks, but maybe sort of the most prominent examples have been malware that's been used in sort of nation-state intelligence. So if you've been following the news, there was a recent attack of SolarWinds, which is network monitoring software, and the attack was someone, you know, churned SolarWinds into the network monitoring software into malware by compromising the company that made it, so what we call a supply chain attack. And this was useful because SolarWinds was used by a lot of parts of the U.S. government and some other important companies. And also, you kind of see this sort of thing in, you know, where there's someone of interest, they'll like email, here's an interesting PDF that's like really a malicious piece of software. So this is sort of information gathering, sort of that sort of happens at the nation state level, very different motivation, probably different ways you'd want to defend against them. And also, you know, this sort of thing has come up in sort of a completely different use of malware for sabotage. So the most prominent public example is Stuxnet, where the industrial control software for Iranian nuclear enrichment was compromised, presumably by some intelligence agency that is either in the North America, Western Europe, or Israel, or some combination. That's just sort of my brief overview of sort of universe of malware, which we're mostly not going to talk about again. But I want to mention it because, especially when we're talking about criminal malware, if you're actually dealing with this in the real world, thinking about the motivations behind the malware, and particularly how they make money, is a big thing. That if you track, you know, how do you actually get money from this, that might be a easier way of decreasing the amount of malware you get than, you know, actually looking for the malware directly. So, for example, if we think of stealing bank information, if you make it harder to turn a credit card number into money, that makes the malware that steals credit card numbers less profitable. If you think of click fraud, if you make it harder to fraudulently get ad revenue, you know, from places that are, you know, probably not actually things that real people look at, then that's going to make that type of malware less profitable and make there be less of it. And that's something that in the real world we want to think about. And also, if we think about these markets for malware that for these malware services, that, you know, if it's harder for the person who has the, you know, info stealing malware to sell the info they're stealing, then, you know, that's going to make it less profitable for them and might decrease the amount of malware. Okay. So, we've talked about evil software. Now, one thing we're going to talk about a bunch this semester is going to be vulnerabilities, and this should hopefully be reviewed from 3710. So, for the malware which doesn't spread through some sort of social means like Trojans, and arguably for some software like Trojans and potentially one of the programs that do things that they aren't supposed to be allowed to do, like if you have a browser extension that gets info that probably shouldn't be permitted, or like a mobile app which gets, you know, your location when it's not supposed to. We call this sort of unintended behavior that someone can use in a vulnerability. So, classic example is a website that's able to install software without prompting. That's not something that's supposed to happen in my web browser. That's a vulnerability if that happens. And we're going to be spending, after we talk a bit about sort of malware more generally, a lot of time on this big category that I believe you've seen the basics of memory safety bugs. So I believe in all the versions of 3710, you know, you've seen the classic buffer overflow. So that's sort of one of a big category of things which are problems with pointers that turn into vulnerabilities, to cases where you can cause software to do things they're not supposed to. And we're going to talk about these because there's been a lot of work on exploiting these and defending against these, and because they're a relatively common source of problems in real software. But they're not sort of the only type of vulnerability that you might see out there. So you've definitely seen sort of SQL injection or command injection, which you might talk about a little bit, insofar as we have things to add about defenses for these. And there's other examples of things which commonly become vulnerabilities. So, for example, integer overflow sometimes becomes a vulnerability because, you know, software will do something completely unexpected if a number becomes negative. And there's even more categories. So if you're not checking inputs, so if my web server lets me access a file I shouldn't access because I just tell it to, whoops. Another example I hope to spend a little time on is synchronization issues, that if two things are happening at once, you might not test what if they're both, you know, acting on a shared, you know, file, for example, at the same time. So all these sorts of problems, these bugs, which can result in some unintended behavior that does something, is a vulnerability, and we'll call, you know, what happens an exploit. And, you know, our example of an exploit, I'll use the term a proof of concept, is something that demonstrates that there's actually, you know, that there is an exploit example that, you know, demonstrates that the vulnerability is there, I should say. So, that's going to be, I guess I have, I'm basically time. So I'm going to skip over, we'll talk about malware defenses later. So an assignment note. So we have some homework assignments. The first assignment, which is due next week, so it's not urgent, is get an appropriate environment working. We'd like you to have access to this particular type of Linux environment. I hope the assignments will work in other 64-bit Linux environments, but this is what I'm going to be testing in. And sort of basically what the big things we're going to be getting to next is we're going to talk a bit about assembly and reverse engineering. And then we're going to look at, now that we know sort of how to analyze programs, how we can do sort of detect malware, do the classic antivirus software thing of let's find malware by knowing what it looks like. And then we're going to talk about why this doesn't really work. So this is why I'm saying it's a cat and mouse game. And then we're going to probably spend most of our time looking at exploits and mitigations, starting with a bunch of time spent on memory mismanagement issues. Okay, so I think that's where I'll call it today. So next time we'll start by talking about assembly. And if the VM image link doesn't work, that is, I can look at that issue. Did I make a broken link there? Okay, let's see if link settings. Oh, well, that's probably important. Okay, so maybe that will fix the VM image, which was set to invited people only. So hopefully you should be able to download that VM image. As the instructions on the web page say, you can also like make your own VM, and that's fine. And I believe that I should be able to make assignments work in any normal 64-bit Linux installation. Okay. Anything else before I sign off?